Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right, a very good morning to you wherever you're listening, San Antonio, Hill Country, down toward the coast, or who knows where you might be listening on the internet, but looks like it's going to be, let's just say, an interesting weekend around here. It's not going to be especially cold. That's good news. The other good news is looks like we have a pretty good chance of substantial rain. The not so good news is it may involve some fairly severe storms, but you know, we'll take that when it comes. And anyway, going to be lots of the weekends, going to be a great time to get some gardening done. And we'll talk a little while maybe about protecting those plants if we do get much of a storm. But anyway, you know, I hate to keep people waiting. By the way, we've got one open line if you want to grab it. You know the number, 210-599-5555. We have Gary and Dave and Clint all waiting to talk. So we'll save my stuff for later. Let's get started with the calls. And Gary, you're first. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
I have a split leaf philodendron that I've had in a very large pot for about since the last real bad freeze of 2 or 3 years ago, and this time it got zapped pretty bad. I ran out of time and energy to bring it in, but anyway, it's starting to show some signs of life from the bottom. Now, if on top of the soil level in the large pot, it has a bulbous structure. And it has another structure that looks like that's circling around at the top of the soil level that looks almost like a root. Mm-hmm. The new growth is coming out from below that,
right,
below that bulbous structure. My question is, how far do I cut it back?
Well, so this is obviously the philodendron psilloum, the one that has the great big roots kind of go all over the place and the big finger-like leaves. Okay, there's a different split leaf that is actually the true split leaf that is more of a house plant, but you have philodendron psilloum. You can cut it back at almost any point. I would, you know, grab the upright stem fairly firmly and just squeeze it. If it's really hard, then just cut it down near, maybe 2 or 3 inches above where all the new growth is coming out. If it feels at all soft and mushy, go ahead and cut it down even further than that until you get down to fairly solid wood. But it's going to come out, and, you know, by the end of the summer, it's going to be rather large. You'll hardly even know it froze back. You just won't have that big trunk coming up. But I suspect when you squeeze that trunk, you're going to find it's hard. And if that's the case, just carefully cut it off, I'd say 3 inches above where the new growth's coming out. And the new growth will come out and hide that ugly stump pretty quickly. But I'm afraid if you go any lower than that, you could potentially damage some of the new leaves and things that are coming out. So that's what I would do with it. And remember that while it doesn't have any leaves on it, it's not using as much moisture. So water it super, super thoroughly when you water. But then be sure you let it get dry about an inch or so deep, about a knuckle deep, before you water it again. Feed it regularly with Hastero plant or something like that, and you'll have a big split leaf, you know, by the time summer's halfway over.
What about those the pencil size look like root like structures that are circling the top of the pot? Do I do anything with those, or
are they coming? Can you tell where they are coming off the principal stem itself? Are they coming off the near ground level, coming off below ground level, near ground level?
I would say right at ground level, at ground level.
Yeah. Well, do the same thing. Thumb and forefinger, give those things a good squeeze. If they're solid, leave them alone. If it feels like they're dry and hollow with just sort of a hard core down the middle, then go ahead and, you know, cut them off as far back as you can. But if they feel solid, I would leave them. They probably are. That probably is what is supporting the new growth on your plant.
Okay. Can I ask one more?
Of course you can, but one other thing. Don't worry about girdling roots, and don't worry about it being root-bound. Those are not issues with a philodendron sloam.
Okay. Now, on tomatoes.
Yeah.
I know that you said you typically plant two tomato plants. I have big whiskey barrels, very large whiskey barrels. Now, when I bought these tomatoes, you know, they're two plants, for lack of a better term, they're like conjoined. They're joined at the bottom. Is that acceptable to leave it like that?
Absolutely. You do more damage trying to break them apart than you would leaving them together. What variety of tomato did you purchase?
This is a Celebrity.
Okay. In a whiskey barrel size container, you've got room probably to put three plants in there. Since these two are, you know, basically fused, go ahead and put a third plant in there somewhere if you like. They don't mind being a little crowded. In fact, it may keep the fruit from getting sunburned, and you might as well get the maximum growth, the biggest number of tomatoes you can out of it. And a whiskey barrel is big enough to handle three plants. So that's what I do. Go ahead and put your good tomato cage over them as soon as you can.
Appreciate it, sir.
One more thing. Are you here in San Antonio area? Where are you?
Northeast.
Okay. You may want to wait until Monday to actually plant them, because they are giving us, and, you know, the weathermen are never right, but you just can't trust them. The one time you don't prepare, then the bad stuff might happen. And they are saying potential for some hail, severe thunderstorms this afternoon and tonight. So if I were you, I'd keep those plants safe and sound, and maybe tomorrow afternoon or Monday stick them in the whiskey barrel.
Okay. All righty.
Don't forget to put a layer of rock phosphate underneath them when you plant. That'll double the number of pounds of tomatoes you get.
I've got it ready to go.
Yeah, good for you. You get out and enjoy, Gary. Thanks for the call this morning.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Thank you.
Bye.
Next in line is Dave. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Bob.
Well, good morning. I know that voice.
Okay, I just want to start out. I've got several questions, but I actually have a piece of paper, and I'm going to write the answers down this time. But I want to say that my ginkgo that looked like a scarecrow last fall, it's pushing leaves all up and down all the branches. So
very good.
That's exciting.
Very good.
Out the tip. All right, I have a very large crepe myrtle. It's 30-plus feet tall, 26 inches at the base, and the other David even commented about the root flare.
Okay.
I've got some kind of weedy grass that shows up in the spring, and then it just kind of dies off. It's really hard to grow any kind of good grass under that guy. And it will shoot up. It'll shoot up a little shoot from the roots.
Oh, yeah.
So the roots, I think, around the base must be fairly shallow. I want to create just a mulched bed around there. Is there a way I can? Can I use your vinegar solution to kill that stuff? Or will that affect the roots?
No, it should not be any problem whatsoever. It will burn any foliage that might be coming out, but you probably don't want those little shoots coming out anyway. Just remember, all you're wanting to do is to coat the leaves of the plants you want to be rid of. You're not going to want to soak the soil with it. Wouldn't hurt if you get a fair amount of it on the soil. But just spray enough to coat the leaves, and don't worry about your... Is it kind of a light pink color? Is that what color your crepe myrtle is?
Well, it's obviously an old one. It's 30-some feet tall.
Right,
it's,
right.
I think it's a pink, deep pink.
Yeah, it's probably one called Basham's Party Pink. It's the one that gets 30, 35 feet tall. But, yeah, and it's a good plant. You've got the root flare exposed, so you're ahead of 90% of the people out there. And, no, I wouldn't have any hesitation.
Yeah, I didn't plant it. It was here when I bought the house. And the blessing about it is that it's never been crepe murdered, so it's really a nice specimen.
Go ahead.
How often... should I put the cornmeal solution around oaks?
Do you have oak wilt in the neighborhood, or is this just general prevention?
Yes. No, it's okay. In the neighborhood.
I would probably do it once or twice a year. If it's within a house or two of you, I'd do it, you know, 2 to 4 times a year. If it's just in the neighborhood, twice a year is probably adequate.
Okay. I'd like to buy some compost in bulk, which I've done before when I put it on the lawn. And mm-hmm. And we've got a large flower bed, needs to have some labor work to get some weeds out. And so I can't get it cleaned up all at once. How long can I keep a pile of it if I store it and buy it in bulk? Can I?
Absolutely indefinitely. But realize that most of the compost you buy is still in the breakdown process. And over time, that pile, even if you don't take a shovelful away from it, it's going to shrink. And just through the natural decomposition, the little particles get closer together. And I always laugh thinking back to, you know, we all knew old Malcolm Beck so well. And I used to fuss at Malcolm because he sold compost sometimes way before it was ready. And he looked at me and he said, Bob, I have to sell it like this because if I wait until it's ready, it's going to shrink so much in size, I'd have to charge so much for it, people couldn't afford it. So it certainly doesn't hurt to stay stacked. It's probably going to continue to generate some heat, but that's only, you know, further breakdown going on, and it's not harmful in any way. But if you put a, you know, a 5-yard pile of it out, a small dump truck pile of it out, and it's 3 months before you get around to using it, you're probably going to have about 3.5 yards of compost left. And that's just from the natural breakdown. You're taking bigger things like leaves and twigs and bark and who knows what else they put in there. And those things, as they decompose, they just break down into smaller particles, which, you know, stay closer together, not like forming a, you know, a clay or anything like that. But you're fine to leave it, just leave it in a pile there. But like I say, don't be surprised when you go out and you feel like there's not as much there as there was 2 weeks ago.
Sure, but there's no microisms that are breaking down and going away or anything like that.
Well, they're not too, you know, not anything that would be unexpected or negative. The microorganisms, in fact, microorganisms in general, especially bacteria, are classified as psychrophilic, mesophilic, or thermophilic. And that basically means there are some of them that operate at very high temperatures, some of them that operate at middle temperatures, and some of them that operate when it's really cold. And through the natural process of decomposition or starting a compost pile, you're going to start out with some very heat-tolerant microbes, bacteria in particular, but some fungi, you're going to start out with some very heat-tolerant ones. As the temperature naturally decreases, as the decomposition progresses, you're going to get a different flora, so to speak, of microbes. And then when the decomposition process is all done, you're going to have still a third general group of microbes. Now, realize that there may be, you know, 10,000 varieties of thermophilic, 10,000 varieties of, you know, psychrophilic, and, you know, 100,000 varieties of the mesophilic. So, yes, you're going to have, your microbes are going to come and go, so to speak, but that's not negative and is not unexpected or a problem. And you'll have, it would be good if you can moisten that pile periodically, because if it gets real dry, some of your microbes are going to die. About half of them have the capacity to go into a resting state. If you maintain a little bit of moisture in that pile, you know, 100% of the ones that are adapted to the temperature will remain there and continue to carry on their good work. Does that make sense?
But I don't. Yes, it does. But I don't need to cover it.
Absolutely not. That would be a big mistake. And if you had to cover it, like we, you know, we were covering, you know, not to get too personal, but took down a section of gutter, expecting somebody to come out and fix it, and that didn't happen because the gentleman got ill. But we were concerned now, okay, we got all of a sudden where we used to have a gutter, there's going to be rain pounding down off of the roof if this storm hits. So we put underneath it, we just put some burlap bags here at the nursery. One of our big suppliers uses burlap bags to pack some of the statuary we get. By the way, if you ever need burlap bags, we give them away. But we use something like that, and it gets, you know, they totally allow the air back and forth through it. So that's not a bad thing to cover with. But the last thing you want to do is put a tarp or a piece of plastic or something like that over your compost pile, because that cuts off the oxygen, and that'll be terribly detrimental to your microbes.
Do you recommend covering it just with burlap or something?
If you know, it depends. You're going to have a you're going to have moisture. You're going to have some brown humic material leach out of it that's going to stain concrete and things like that. So, if you're concerned about that, or if it's on a slope where some of it's going to wash away, yeah, cover it. Otherwise, don't worry about it. You know, that set out in its windrow while it was breaking down for, you know, months before you got it. So you're just keeping it from washing away. Now, if we had one of these periods that we haven't had in a long time where it set in and, you know, rained every day for 2 weeks, then it might be good to cover it just to keep it from getting waterlogged, because, of course, when you get that much water, you're driving the oxygen out, and that's not good for the microbes. But it's been years since we had that kind of rainy spell. And this is looking like a fairly brief one. So if you're worried about it washing away, cover it. If you're not, just let it sit there and soak up the moisture.
I've got several small trees, the ginkgo, the couple of red buds. How often should I put azomite on them?
Maximum, you know, you really don't need to do it more than every 6 months. I would probably say once a year is going to be adequate, because azomite, of course, is a rock powder. And it lasts a long time, but you've got so many different individual elements and so many different compounds in there that some of them are going to be depleted over time. So I think it's good to do it maybe every 6 months, but if it's once a year when you get around to it, don't worry about it. It's there's no such thing as too much or too little. Any azomite you put out will benefit. If you put out too much, it's only going to hurt your bank account. It's not going to hurt the plants.
Yeah, and this is a good time of the year?
Anytime's a good time of year. Again, it's
all right.
This is a fine time of year.
All right, final question. If that hail comes, I'm going to be out on that ginkgo with an umbrella. Do you know what time you expect it?
I am not foolish enough to try to forecast weather, and these clowns that do have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. So how tall is your ginkgo now?
The sucker was, I got it from that wonderful place on the southeast side, and so I think it grew up in the shade, and so it's only about an inch and a half in diameter, but it's probably 8 feet tall. And so,
okay. Well, I was going
to
say,
on a ladder, Bob.
Yeah, if it were under 6 feet, I'd say put a tomato cage over it and then put something over that. You know, they're saying small hail, but once again, who believes the weatherman? So there's not a lot you can do about it, Dave. If anything, you could take, if you had a feed sack or something like that, that you could just kind of slip down over the top of the tree. The only real problem, and it would only be a problem if we get big hail, is you could have hail big enough to break small branches. What I would be more really concerned about is you could scar the trunk up and down that, which would, it's not going to be devastating, but it's going to set the tree back a little bit. So, you know, if you had a big feed sack or something, or this, you could simply, you know, put a case over the top to protect it. That would probably be the most efficient, practical thing that you could do.
Yeah, I've got a couple 8-foot stepladders. I might park those right beside it and see if I can.
Oh, yeah, and that'd be perfect if you have a stepladder that's higher than the tree. I'll just put that over the top of it and then drape something. You know, I watch Etter, our great tree professionals, when they're doing something like that, they'll actually set a stepladder up over the top of whatever they're wanting to protect in case one of their guys accidentally drops a limb while he's up there pruning. So yeah, stepladder is a great protection. Just be aware that if you put anything that's that would catch the wind, that stepladder will stand there in a high wind, but you drape a tarp over it or something like that, it'll blow over even in a small breeze. So once again, if you got a bag of potting soil or something like that that you can use to anchor that ladder in place, it'd probably be a good idea if you're going to put anything with any substantial sail potential over the top of it.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Great questions. Always good to hear from you. You get out and have a great weekend.
Okay.
Thanks, Dave. Let's see. Next in line is our friend Clint. Good morning, Clint.
Hello, how's it going?
Oh, the anticipation of rain is always a nice thing. The disappointment isn't so much when it never happens, but they're actually looking, saying, being fairly confident we're going to get at least something out of this. So, you know, optimism is a big part of my life, though it's not always well-founded. So we're hoping for the rain, but looking forward to whatever comes.
Well, I'll believe it when I see it, because that last weather, man.
Amen to that one.
I got a new weed. I need a little help with the ID on it. It looks more like a ground cover. The leaves are a really unique shade of green, and it produces a bright purple five-leaf flower petal that's really, really tiny, smaller than the head of a pencil.
Okay.
Any idea what that might be?
Is the leaf at all rough? Is it a very fine-grained sandpaper consistency to it?
Well, I didn't really touch the leaf, but it's kind of like the potato chips, rigidy, rough.
Okay. I would look up pelargonium, P-E-L-A-R-G-O-N-I-U-M. It's probably a wild geranium is what it sounds like. And it another name for it is crane's bill, because after it blooms, it will make a slender, maybe inch-long pointed seed pod up on top that I guess looks kind of like a crane's bill. But that's what it sounds like to me. Upright, it usually grows as much as 8 or 10 inches high, occasionally higher, and kind of an interesting little plant. It's not a noxious weed in any way.
Pelargonium?
Pelargonium, P-E-L-A-R-G-O-N-I-U-M, Pelargonium. Technically it's related. Geraniums are pelargonium, so is the crane's bill. They're just kind of a little ways apart on the phylogenetic chart.
And I'm assuming the orange oil vinegar will take care of that.
It will. Yeah, it will. It generally, if you cut it off at ground level, it doesn't come back. It's one of those ones that's usually fairly easy to pull up. So if you've got a bunch of it to do, spray it. If not, just put your gloves on and pull it out and throw it in the compost pile.
Okay. And what chances would a pistachio tree be okay here?
There's a Texas pistache and a Chinese pistache. A Texas pistache is basically a big bush, and it's a pretty tree, and it does fairly well, or a pretty bush if you want to look at it that way. Chinese pistache will be an ugly tree the first 10 years it's in the ground. The only redeeming factor of Chinese pistache is that it has wonderful fall color. Has some of the best fall color you'll find anywhere. But it can be, even if it's sold to you as a male tree, it seems like they can do their own sex change thing. And when it blooms and produces seed, it will be almost not as bad as a hackberry, but it's gonna send or throw out a lot more seed, which will germinate and grow than you probably want. So it's not high on my list of desirable trees, but I'm not gonna say it's bad. We used to have an extension agent here named Steve George, and boy, he just made it sound like the best tree in the world, and everybody had to plant one, and a lot of people did, and 2 years later, 95% of those people were cutting them down and getting rid of them because they didn't like the way they grew. I think the Chinese pistache and the red-tipped photinia are the two main reasons he had to leave town and go up to the Dallas area.
So basically, you just buy the pistachios at the store.
Oh, you're talking about for edible. No, that's a Mediterranean pistache. That's not the Chinese pistache that people put in the garden. Yeah. Yeah. Buy them at the store and enjoy them.
Okay. Now, I put the azomite out yesterday, hoping for, the rain coming in. How well does that take effect on the grass?
Oh, it's wonderful. And it's a great time to put it out because things are starting to put on new growth. So it'll never burn. It's absolutely fine putting it out on the grass and everywhere. Glad, hang on just a second. We can talk a little bit more if you like. I've got to get out for news. This is KTSA Radio in San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening, and let's get straight back to the phone lines. We're going to talk a little more with Clint, and then it will be Elaine and Matt. Good morning again, Clint.
Okay, so you said the azomite does kick in the grass on growth and root.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it getting it on ahead of a rain would be absolutely perfect because, like I say, there's not any what we would call active ingredient in there. There's nothing that's going to burn. It's more like, my line is like green sand on steroids. It has so many things in that benefit plant growth. And getting a little moisture on the soil is going to activate the microbes that, tend to free that up and make it available to the plants. So, yeah, grass, vegetables, ground covers, new trees, old trees, just about anything out there will benefit from some azomite.
Each fruit tree got a 2 scoops of a tomato can dumped all around it, so hopefully that really kicks them in too.
Oh, that'll be good, great thing for fruit trees as well as shade trees. And I can't really think of any vascular plants that won't benefit from it.
And how often you say is optimal to do that? Twice a year?
Again, it seems, and I'm just going from where we have used it on things like periwinkles that have a case of yellowing. It seems like it lasts for 6 months or a little longer. Anything will help. I think more than twice a year would probably be flat more than you need to use. But anything that shows any tendency toward yellowing or chlorosis of any sort, I'd probably use it twice a year. Other things, I think once a year is going to be plenty. Even that may be more than you need to do.
Okay. Now, on tomatoes, harvesting celebrities and stuff like that, if you save the seeds, will that produce the celebrity the next year?
It will produce a celebrity-like tomato. Of course, every time something reproduces through, we have to say, sexual reproduction, joining of male and female parts, you get a unique genome. You get a unique set of DNA there. So if you got 1,000 seed and you could identify, if you could look into their DNA, you would have 1,000 different plants there. Because celebrity is an older variety that has been self-pollinated over and over and over, most of the gene pairs are the same, which means that chances are much higher that you're going to get a plant that comes out looking pretty much like a celebrity, much more so than you would with a newer hybrid. So you're going to get a good tomato plant out of the deal. Is it a celebrity? No. The only way you can have a true celebrity would be a cutting, from a plant that is a celebrity.
Do the same hold true for the heirloom seeds?
Well, celebrities, bordering on being an heirloom in my variety. It's been around for a lot of years. But, yes, that's what makes the heirloom seeds, most all of them, come true, from seed. And the thing about tomatoes is that they are wind-pollinated rather than insect-pollinated, so they are usually self-pollinated. And just it's a part of the evolutionary process as you get more and more a pure genetic strain so that it comes back true. So, most all of your heirlooms are what we call open pollinated, and you can pretty much, and people kind of label the seed as the same variety, although, like I say, technically, there are going to be genetic differences, but you would never know it. So, yeah, I'm Celebrity's been around long enough that I will put it in the same category as heirloom tomatoes, and will almost, 99% of them will come true from seed.
True from seed. Good deal. All right, well, I appreciate your time.
I appreciate the call, Clint. Get out and have a great weekend, and pray for some good rain out of the deal. And we'll move along and talk to Elaine next. Good morning, Elaine.
Good morning. I'm praying for rain, too.
Amen. Hope our prayers are answered today.
Amen. I need some suggestions on what kind of a flowering shrub I could plant in an area that only gets the morning sun, like up to 12 o'clock, and the soil is very sandy.
You're not going to find a lot of shrubs, per se. There are a number of perennials, some of which may get 2 or 3 feet tall, at least, that will give you lots of color. But flowering shrubs tend to be, they're things like azaleas, but they're going to be pretty for 2 weeks out of the year. Hydrangeas, which are going to be super, super thirsty plants. But when you start looking at flowering perennials that can easily get 2 to 3 feet tall, I would say shrimp plant is going to be a really good choice. Plumbago is going to be a really good choice. There is a native perennial called Turk's Cap. Now, it's going to get a little taller. Oh, gosh, the one in my yard is probably 4 feet tall easily, and it comes red, pink, or white. There's also one they call the giant Turk's Cap, which is absolutely spectacular, but it only blooms for a few weeks out of the year in the fall. Your other Turk's Cap will bloom throughout the warm season, and it is a beautiful perennial that will do well in the shade. There is another shrubby plant, which is called American Beautyberry, which doesn't have spectacular flowers, but it's unique in that it forms clusters of berries all up and down the stem in the spring, and then by fall, when the leaves start to drop off, most of them turn a brilliant purple color. There's a white form, but 99% of them are, very attractive purple. If you were looking for something else that blooms that would be a big shrub, in fact, you almost consider it a small tree, there's something called Mexican buckeye. Ugnatia is its botanical name, I believe. But it's in bloom right now. Beautiful pink flowers all over it. But it's only going to bloom for a few weeks out of the year. But it has great yellow fall foliage. It's deer resistant. It's very, very drought tolerant. So Mexican buckeye would be a big shrub that I guess you could actually prune to be a small tree. And it is very shade tolerant. Beyond that, there are a couple of other salvias, deciduous salvias, ones that freeze down. There's one of them that's called eyelash sage, another one called smoothleaf sage. These bloom with beautiful red flowers, and the plant's going to be about 18 inches to 2 feet high. There's a slightly smaller one called salvia coccinea, or tropical sage. It comes red, pink, and white. Throw seed everywhere. The big plants may not survive the winter, but you'll have plenty of seedlings come up. But it will give you a great burst of color out in a shady area. I tell you, if you ever buy shades of green, we have all this written down. So rather you're sitting there trying to copy it all down, when you're sometimes just say, let me have a copy of your shade list, and everybody will know what you're asking about.
Okay. Do you have that on a website or something, your shade list?
What do you mean? Do we have it on a website?
I mean, do you have it? Have it?
Oh, on a website. Go to shadesofgreensa.com. I quite honestly don't know if we do or not. We have a website, but websites take maintenance. And when it comes to, are you going to work on the website or wait on the customers? We're going to wait on the customers. So I'm not sure whether it's up there yet or not.
I currently have a plumbago in that area, and it kind of, it's okay, but I just was hoping it would flower more than it does. And I was thinking maybe there's something else out there that I'm not aware of.
Well, look at shrimp plant. Shrimp plant is interesting. Okay. The hummingbirds love it. And do look at the Turk's Cap. Most of the Turk's cap I'm seeing this year are still a little small. You'll find much bigger ones in the nursery a little later in the year, but it's a wonderful hardy perennial. You know, I water mine two or three times a year, whether it needs it or not. And the red is by far the most popular, but the pink is also attractive and I think makes an even bigger plant. Mine probably is pushing, 5 feet by the end of the summer. Then I usually cut it back to ground level, early spring, and it's already starting to come back out.
Good. I had another question. The caller before me was asking about azomite. Does that help prevent grass burrs?
No. No, if you want to prevent grass burrs, a good layer of compost is the best thing you can use. There is a natural pre-emergent called corn gluten meal. Not cornmeal, but corn gluten meal. But the problem with pre-emergents, they don't kill the seedlings. They don't destroy the burrs at all. They don't hurt the seeds. But when the seed germinates and starts to grow, the corn gluten meal keeps it from forming a root system, and if we have dry weather, which we usually do, little seedling shrivels and dies instead of growing up. But the problem is grass burrs can germinate any time from March till October and still make those blasted burrs. And so you'd end up putting whatever else out, 4, 5, or 6 times a year, which would get expensive. I had an area in my front yard, area that's probably 25 feet wide and 30, 35 feet long. We used it as a croquet court, and the grass burrs were so thick in there that the dogs wouldn't walk into it. And I put maybe between 1/4 and 1/2 inch of compost over that area. I actually did it in November, but you could do it this time of year. And the next summer, I think I pulled like 4 grass burrs the whole summer. So my opinion is that good compost is the best grass burr control you've got.
Okay. All right. And another question. What type of fertilizer could I put? I found a Lynn's Legacy. Mm-hmm. And what type of fertilizer does that need?
Same sort of thing you would put on the rest of your landscape. Medina makes a really good one called Growing Green. Maestro Grow makes one called Texas Tea. Nature's Creation makes a couple of different ones. One of them's called Lawn and Turf Food, and the other's called Premium Lawn and Garden Food. Lynn's Legacy is just a slightly different color of the so-called Purple Sage or Senesa, and it's interesting. It's, of course, named for Lynn Lowry, who discovered that particular variety. But, any of the things you would put on your other shrubs and grass, your Lynn's Legacy will love it.
Okay, because I do have a lot of the Medina products. And I was just wondering
if you use a dry one, use the Growing Green. If you want to use a liquid one, either use Hester Grow Plant or the Liquid Fish Blend.
Okay, good. I have both of those. Well, all three of those. That'll work.
Well, use all three of them. Do you have this in the ground or in a pot?
Yeah, I put it in the ground.
I have an
area that's just total sun, and it's so hot in the summer. And I was trying to think what could tolerate that heat.
Well, you made a good choice. Just keep it well watered this first year, and pretty soon it'll take it on its own. Liquid fertilizers are faster acting. The granular fertilizers are longer lasting. So if you like Medina products, Growing Green is the dry one. Has to grow plant and the Liquid Fish Blend are your 2 good liquids for that use.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, I thank you so much. And I made a good choice because I listen to your program all the time.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you. And get out and watch out for hailstones, but have a good weekend. Thanks, Elaine.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're certainly welcome. Bye. Matt, hang on just a second. Got to get a break in here. And then you are up next. Looks like I actually get to talk about azomite. Good little coincidence there. Azomite is a natural rock mineral product. It's an ore. I think it's mined from a very special site out in Arizona. And it contains almost 100 different individual elements and micronutrient compounds that benefit plants a great deal. It's not toxic. It will never burn. It comes in a powdered form, which is so finely micronized, you can actually put it in suspension. As long as you keep shaking it, you can put it in water and actually spray it out. I actually prefer the granular form, that you just grab a handful of it and sprinkle it around. And like I say, I've never seen a product that works as well at greening things up. Now, there are a lot of products out there that will green things up, but you're waiting for the new leaves to come out. They come out darker green. Azomite, I've actually seen yellow leaves turn back to being a green again rather than dropping off and having to start over. Azomite's a natural product, reasonably priced, comes in both small and larger bags, and you'll find it just about anywhere quality gardening products are sold. Once again, totally natural, non-burning product. I always say it works like green sand on steroids. I use it in the vegetable garden, use it in the flower beds, and of course out there on the shrubs and trees and other things as well. Azomite, A-Z-O-M-I-T-E.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. Let's go straight back to the phone lines. Matt, James, and Angel, Angel, whichever you prefer. Matt's first in line. Good morning, Matt.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I have two questions. One, I want to ask you about chiltepin, but I want to first ask you about beggar's lice, or I think it's called beggar's lice. That stuff is annoying.
That's an understatement. And there are other names for that, which I cannot say on the air, or the FCC will be after me. I hate that plant.
Yes, sir. So the one I have, it's almost like a real weak, like low laying vine or something, almost. And I guess it's what it's commonly called, is beggar's lice. But I neglected my yard last year, kind of. And so this year, I noticed kind of late. I looked out in the backyard, and I thought, oh, my goodness, that stuff is going crazy. So I went ahead and mowed it. And then I realized, well, I wonder if I should have pulled it by hand. And I'm asking for next spring, because I'm probably going to have to deal with it again.
I think what you're looking at, it's kind of a viney, feels almost like Velcro when you touch it.
Yes, sir. And even the leaves will stick to your shoes and clothes. Yep. Yes, sir.
That is actually called bed straw, and some people call it Velcro weed. But beggar's lice, in my opinion, is even worse. It's more of an upright plant, and it makes these little these little burrs, they don't poke you, but they stick to you. They're about the size of what would I describe them as? Smaller than very fine buckshot. But those things, they stick to the hair on your legs and arms and everything else. What you're describing is more properly called bed straw. And believe it or not, they used to harvest it and stuff mattresses with it. If I get out early, the vinegar and orange oil mix will kill it completely, and it's a very, very weak plant and very easily killed, but it grows, I think, about 4 inches a day. And what I usually do is get out with a hard rake, a grass rake, not a leaf rake, but a grass rake, and just drag out as much of it as I can and throw it in the compost bin or throw it on the burn pile, and as a matter of fact, I was weed eating around my yard last night, and I'm fighting my share of it this year too, thanks to the good rains we've had. But mowing it, you probably spread the seeds around a little bit more. But next year, when you first see it coming up, your grass probably won't have started to green up. And get out there with that vinegar and orange oil, spray lightly, and you will kill it 100%. What you still have, and you're going to still have some of it grow this year, But you can bend over and pull it if you like. It comes up very easily. But I just use my grass rake, and I pull it out by the cubic yard, and like I say, either throw it on the burn pile or throw it in the compost pile. It decomposes in almost nothing. But it is a rather noxious weed. At least it doesn't stick you or sting you. It doesn't hurt you in any way. It's just a real nuisance.
You're right, right. And I was thinking about using orange oil, but I live in Cypress, right northwest of Houston, and my grass is already greening up. It's and it never really went yellow completely, so I hesitated on that. But
mowing it was probably the thing to do. Would have been better to mow it earlier before it really started making seed. But if you got grass that's that good, and you probably do, it's going to choke it out. It's just going to be an early spring nuisance for you. Once you get rid of it, you won't have to deal with it until this time next year.
Right. I'm also dealing with thistle. Like I said, I neglected my yard, and so I went ahead and mowed that too. And I try to catch that before it's the one that gets the puffy little seeds that blow away in the wind.
Right. And they say one plant can make 500,000 seed or something like that. So, the bad thing about that is that even before the buds are fully open, if you cut it, it will still go ahead and develop a viable seed. So what I typically do, and I'm not going to say I neglect, I'm going to say I get busy with other things, which is just a nice way of saying the same things. But I'll go out with my hand shears and a bucket, and I will clip the blooms and the seed pods that are sort of developing. I'll clip them off, and then I'll go back and cut or mow down the bigger plants. And that way I'm, heading off at least some of next year's plants. It's a weird plant in that it is very cyclical. You can have, every year, you can have a few hundred thousand seed produced, and some years you'll get almost no thistles, and some years you will have them just germinate everywhere. This is one of those years that they are germinating everywhere. So just do everything you can to dispose of the seed in some way so that it won't be blowing around and sitting out there waiting for another good year to give you pain.
Right. What would be the common name for that thistle?
Yeah, thistle. They call that one, I think they call that one a Russian thistle. But there is a control for it, but we just haven't been able to get it in this part of the country. There's a little weevil-like beetle that they're using up in the, not far northwest, but up in the Montana area and things like that. And it seems to target this stuff and nothing else, although it's, even more against a nasty little thistle called the Malta star thistle. But they haven't let it out. They haven't started sharing it because it's just a real nuisance. And those spines are sharp, as I'm sure you've discovered. So the sprays, if you get them when they first come up, the vinegar and orange oil will do it. But I consider it one of our more noxious weeds, and hopefully there is a natural control that we'll have one of these days, one of these years. But in the meantime, cut it, mow it, do everything you can. But if those buds, if they're anywhere close to opening, cut them off and dispose of them before they have a chance to open, because you can cut it off and leave it lying on the ground. You go back 2 days later, the thing has opened up and started making seed.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I try to use a grocery plastic bag and put it over it and then cut the stem off. Oh, yeah. So I wanted to ask you about chiltepin. A very good friend of mine gave me some dried sea peppers, chiltepin peppers. And they're the ones, piquin, but the actual chiltepin, the small berry looking. Mm-hmm. How do you cultivate those from dry peppers?
Well, first of all, soak the seed for probably 15 minutes or so in a solution of Garrett juice. And Garrett juice you can buy, or you can go to the dirtdoctor.com website and get the formula and make it yourself. That's one of a group of peppers that are traditionally referred to as bird peppers, because the way they get spread around is the birds, because birds don't taste heat. Birds have no heat receptors in their mouths, so to speak. That's why we can take bird seed and treat it with super hot oil, and the raccoons and squirrels won't touch it, and the birds eat it like mad. But the passing of the seed through the bird's intestine kind of activates the seed, you might say, and so you'll find them coming up wherever the birds sit and, poop. So where you're getting dry peppers that you want to have a higher percentage of the seed germinate, that little soaking Garrett juice serves the same purpose as it would passing through a bird's intestine, and you'll have just a much higher percentage of your seed germinate. I wouldn't soak them a long time, but maybe 15 minutes, and Oh, gosh, a cup of water. I'd probably put a couple of tablespoons of Garrett juice in there.
Hmm. And so I want to break the pepper apart first and then
take the seed out. I would definitely break it apart and take the seed out. And you have a choice. You can either soak the seed, because it's not tiny seed, but if you want to do it a different way, spread the seed out on a piece of parchment. You know what parchment is? The same stuff where butcher paper that we use to wrap meat and things in. Spread it out on that and just take your little mist bottle and mist the seeds with your Garrett juice solution.
Very good. And then as far as placement, I was thinking I've got a west wall that gets sun in the afternoon. And I don't know, I've seen online some people said, you know, it can be under trees or along a fence line or something, but does it have to have full sun or can it have part day sun?
It can have part day sun, but the more sun you have, the more peppers you'll have.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. Well, hopefully I can get one of these things going.
Oh, I don't think you'll have any trouble. If you've got a full pepper, you're probably going to find somewhere between 6 and 10 seeds inside of it, and you'll get at least 50%, probably more like 80% germination. So I think you'll be in pretty good shape, Matt.
Very good. Are they hard to transplant from if you grow them in, say, a peat pot and then cut it open? Or they? I've heard some people say that they're hard to transplant. They don't like.
Well, no, they're easy to transplant from a pot. Now, I don't like peat pots because they really stunt the root systems. But you can start them in a peat pot and then just peel the sides off the peat moss. That's going to set them back a little bit. But I think any nursery you visit will give you a stack of used 4-inch plastic pots, and that's how I would recommend starting them.
Very good. And just start them off, having them in a windowsill or something, and then keep them watered.
This time of year, put them outside. We're going to have a couple of nights in the 40s, so you might wait a week or so before you put them outside. But for your, let's see, what's the next holiday somebody might want to give you something? Father's Day, if nothing before then. Tell them you want a propagating mat, these little rubberized mats that have electric heating cables in them. You set your pots on top of those, and you'll be amazed the difference it makes in how quick the seeds sprout and how well the root system develops.
Very good. Well, I think I've gotten all my questions answered. I appreciate you taking the call.
Well, it's my pleasure. You get out and have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, James, hang on just a second. I've got to get a break in here, and it looks like I am going to talk to you about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center, and they want you to know they're having a free vegetable seminar this morning, 9 o'clock over there, and that's always fun. You know, go learn from some of the real experts about about good vegetable gardening. And they also, they have the folks from Medina are going to be there both today and tomorrow. And to celebrate that fact, they're giving 20% off on all the Medina products, and that includes the Has to Grow, the Growing Green Fertilizer, everything Medina makes that Fanix has. You're going to get a 20% discount on it today and tomorrow. Fanix also has quite a selection of trees, from fruit trees to shade trees. They've got some interesting, I've got to get by and see some of this. They carry that Ego line of lithium-ion battery-powered outdoor equipment, and they say they even have a riding mower now. I'm having trouble visualizing that, but just one more reason to go by Fanix and see what all they have. Lots of plants that qualify for the SAWS Water Saver Rebate Program. Fanix is just a big nursery with everything you need. Lots of organic products, soils, compost, mulch, and like I say right now, great selection of winter, cool weather vegetables, along with lots of tomatoes, lots of peppers, lots of onions, and of course, seed potatoes as well. Just a great day to go to Fanix over on Home Green Road, right where they've been for 85 years now. Check out the website for upcoming events. It's Fanix, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanixNursery.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. My next two callers are going to be James and Paul and Raul. James is first. Good morning, James.
Hey, good morning, Bob. How are you today?
I'm off to a good start. How about yourself?
Oh, enjoying a little bit of rain. I've I've been transplanted up to Lubbock, and so everything I know about South Texas gardening is totally wrong up here, understandably.
Yes, sir.
I've got a couple questions. I've got pecan trees and oak trees, and we always have tons of both that, let's just say, the dog soils them. So I've been running them through the wood chipper, and which turns them into basically meal. Do I need to compost that before I add it in? Because it doesn't seem to break down, but at least they don't grow.
You can, if you just put them on the surface, like as a mulch, just, you know, put them out just as they come out of the wood chipper. If you're actually wanting to blend them into the soil, it would be good to compost them for a while first. They're going to be pretty high in nitrogen because there's a lot of protein, you know, in the seeds. But I recommend more using as a mulch on the surface than trying to mix them into the soil. And you can do that. We've even been known to take the wood chipper and just set it up so it just blows it out over the root zone of trees and just move it around periodically.
Okay. That sounds good. And then the other question I have is, I'm trying to find a good ground cover that'll survive the difference in temperature up here. You know, we get the good hot summers like y'all, not quite as hot, but, you know, 2-3 weeks of freezing.
Yeah.
Sometimes
severe cold. Is this area going to be shady or sunny?
It's mostly shady.
Okay.
Big oak tree.
Yeah, there is a vine called vinca, V-I-N-C-A. Don't confuse it with the flowering thing we call, periwinkles that come in many, many different colors. You have vinca major and vinca minor. Vinca minor has a slightly smaller leaf. It does bloom periodically with a lavender flower, but it is very cold hardy, and it will be evergreen in all but the very coldest winters, and then I think it will come back for you pretty well. And like I say, this is an evergreen ground cover. There is also a plant, and I don't like the name of it. It's called dwarf plumbago, but it's not a plumbago. Its name is Ceratostigma plumbagioides, which means looks like plumbago. Beautiful dark blue flower, nice, you know, green foliage that turns brilliant red in the fall, but it goes away completely in the winter. It always comes back. It's drought resistant, deer resistant, heat resistant, but it makes a great, great ground cover, but it goes away in the winter months. So I would at least consider that. If you want something evergreen, I truly think probably one of the vincas, either major or minor, is going to be probably your best choice.
Okay, and then I guess my last question is, you know, we've got 4 or 5 good garden nurseries up here, but none of them seem to carry the organic stuff we need. I've been lucky to find Medina at, of all places, Lowe's.
Yeah.
But I can't find anything. You know, I can get some vinegar up here, and I get some molasses, and actually azomite. I found a supplier who manufactures it, which is great. I've got powdered right now, but any suggestions up in this part of the world where I could find?
Ask your nurseries, if they do business with a company called B as in Boy, W as in William, I as in Idiots, because all they carry is chemical stuff. But anyway, BWI is a big supplier that I think covers the panhandle as well. And they can order you anything you want. They may expect you to buy a case of it, but, you know, Medina products and some of those things, a case, you'll go through it fairly quickly. But if they do business with BWI, they can get things for you, and they might just find there's a bigger market for them than they realize.
Okay, that sounds great. I appreciate it. That's it. And we're getting a little bit of drizzle. It's been steady all night up here, so that part's good, but
yeah.
I hope y'all get some good rain, but not all at once.
We'll take the rain. I just want it in liquid form rather than solid form. When I left home, I was the same way, drizzling enough. I had to turn the windshield wipers on low, but when I got to San Antonio, completely dry. So you guys just keep the heavy, hard stuff up in the panhandle, and we'll take the liquid stuff down here. Get out, and James, I really appreciate you calling. You get out and enjoy this day.
You too. Thank you. I appreciate it, Bob.
Thank you, sir. Goodbye. I got a little behind on that last one, Raul, so be patient with me while I get one more break out of the way, and then it will be your turn. I get to talk about Wild Birds Unlimited, and that's such a pleasure. We've got Wild Birds Unlimited out there at the corner in the shopping center at the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner, and I don't think it's a secret, but they're about to open a second location up on the north end of Burney. So those of y'all, you know, up in that area, you'll have a Wild Birds Unlimited out there before too long as well. And they want to remind you that birds are nesting now. Birds need protein to feed those little ones, and it's very important that you give them the right sources of food. Some of the seeds are good for nesting birds, but some of the suet cake is even better. They can tell you all about it. Kyle and his staff have a great deal of experience, and they know the answer to all your birding questions. Get those nesting boxes up, because a lot of birds are just starting to nest, and a lot of the purple martins haven't arrived back yet. So if you're hoping to attract a colony this year, go ahead and put that house up. And Wild Birds Unlimited has everything you need. Of course, they also have the cleanest and freshest seed, always adjusted for the proper time of year, as well as feeders, many of which carry a lifetime guarantee. Wild Birds Unlimited has it all when it comes to things for nature. And they're also a great gift shop. They have lots of beautiful things to brighten up your outdoor areas. It's just a great place to visit. I do a lot of gift shopping out there, and because my friends are mostly outdoor people or people who love nature, they have a lot of things that are just beautiful additions to your yard, like wind chimes and fountains, and I could go on and on about them. You just need to go see them. Out in the corner there at the of Northwest Military and Huebner, sort of on the side that faces Northwest Military, you'll be amazed at everything they have in the store at Wild Birds Unlimited.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Don tells me we've got several open lines for the first time in the show. If you've been getting a busy signal, give me a call, 210-599-5555, while I talk to Raul. Good morning, Raul.
Hey, good morning, Bob. How are you doing today?
Off to a good start, hoping for a good rain before the day's over, but I'm just the eternal optimist. The weathermen never seem to get it right, but looks like we have a pretty good chance of getting some significant moisture, and that'd sure be welcome.
That's great. You know, I live up in the Dallas area, and we got quite a storm on Thursday, and it rained all day yesterday. It's supposed to rain today. So hopefully we'll give you some later today.
You'll share a little bit with us. Very kind of you, and we appreciate it. So what's going on in Dallas today?
So I went to my favorite little garden store up here in Frisco, family-owned, and I went to go get some dry molasses and beneficial nematodes, and they noticed that they hadn't stocked up with anything, any new nematodes, and so they gave me their expired ones that were for free. They were maybe, I think, it's enough to cover like three-fourths of an acre, a couple of little buckets. And they expired back in, like, December.
Okay.
Do those really, is that really kind of a, should I hold to that expiration date? Should I just throw them away?
Well, again, and that's a great question, but it's kind of like old seed. You're going to have, if you're using the dry form of the nematodes, you're only getting the ones that have a dormant state, so to speak. And you're going to find probably 90% of them are still viable, will still do the job for you. Even the live ones, which come on little sponges, we are learning they've gone from saying they have a 2-week shelf life to saying they have over 2 months of shelf life. So these are pretty tough little critters, and sounds like the price was really right. But just figure however many of them it says are in there. Figure that probably 80% of them are still alive, and by all means, put them out. I think you probably get all the control you need.
Okay, so I tried to do that, I want to say 5 days ago, and then I realized because you have to soak them, right, and then filter.
You know,
out
the I don't normally use the dry ones, so no, I don't think you have to soak them. I think you need to water thoroughly after you put them out. But
no,
remember, these things
I meant to get them out of the. The ones I have, they're like a little plastic bucket, and it looks kind of like little pieces of clay.
Yeah.
And they tell you to put it in like a quart of water, soak it for a while, and then filter it out.
You can do that if you want, or you can just scatter those little pieces out and water thoroughly. There, it's the water that activates them, so to speak, that tells them to come out of their resting state and go to work. So probably happens a little faster if you soak them, but if you put them out dry and then watered, especially since y'all seem to be getting good soaking rains, you're in good shape. They're going to be just fine. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Because it clogged up my the attachment that you put onto the hose to spray it out, the sprayer thing. None of it came out of the of the sprayer. How long can it sit in that little bottle?
Not long. Once you put them in water, really ought to use them within 30 minutes or so. Go ahead and get them out as quickly as you can.
Okay, so those are gone. Okay, well, luckily I got two of them.
Okay, and free is free, but if you want to soak them and filter them, you certainly can. But if you want to just, you know, scatter the little clay-like particles around and let Mother Nature do what Mother Nature would normally do, you'll be fine.
Okay. I thought it said that don't do it in when it's direct sunlight. Is that true? Does that sound right?
Well, again, if it was the middle of July, no, I'd say don't do anything in direct sunlight. But this time of year, I would not be concerned about the sunlight at all. A moist day is better than, you know, a really dry, windy day, simply from the aspect of dehydrating them, desiccating them. But I don't think sunlight's going to be harmful to them at all.
Okay. And then if I recall correctly, you have a science degree, is that right?
You are correct about that, from a great little university up there in Dallas called SMU.
Yeah, I got my master's there, so.
Very good.
Go ponies.
Amen. they need all the help they can get.
the reason I ask is because I'd like to get a little microscope that, you know, my kids are in elementary, so now's a good time to get something, you know, not too expensive, but maybe something where I could see the nematodes and see the stuff that we're doing. What kind would you recommend? And
there are two standard microscope types. We're not talking electron microscopes, which is what I used,
right.
But there's one they call a scanning scope or a stereoscope that basically it's, you know, like binoculars, and you can put anything. I mean, this is the first place I would start, and your kids will be fascinated. You know, look at pictures in a magazine and see how color is actually created and things. And you can get a good little stereoscope for, probably not much more than $100. And I tell you, if you got the time, let me get Don to put you on hold, and I'll tell you a little bit more about this and a couple of potential sources. And everybody else, we'll be right back after news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening. We're going to talk a little more with Raul, and then it will be Carol and Tony, and potentially you right after that. But Raul, these little binocular scopes or stereoscopes, your kids will absolutely love them. You can get you can get up to, I think, 30 diameters of magnification. 15 is probably enough for a little starting scope, and you will find the good ones will have two light sources. They have a light that shines down from above, which will illuminate whatever you put on what's called the stage of the microscope, and then they will have a light that's underneath the stage, and if you have something thin on there, you can actually see through it, so to speak. So these little scopes shouldn't be too terribly expensive. If you want to go one step up, and how old are your kids?
4, 7, and 9.
Okay, then this is all the scope you want to have. A microscope, which you'd actually put something on a slide and be able to see through it, which, I don't know, you might want to get one of these, but it's going to be something that you set it up, and you can look and see many, many little microscopic creatures that we all saw in Biology 1, from the paramecium to the amoeba to, you know, some of the different interesting fungi. But I definitely would start with that little stereoscope. I don't know where to tell you to look for them in the Dallas area. We have a wonderful company here in San Antonio called Analytical Scientific. That's where I got, or where we got our good scope. In fact, we have a couple of scopes. They have little that little stereoscope, and then we have one that we get up to 400 diameters magnification, which is what we use for analyzing compost tea and things like that. But call Analytical Scientific and ask if they do any mail order type things. I just know their quality, and I'm sure you probably have somebody in that area. And to find somebody in that area, what I would do is maybe call the local high school, or, you know, even call one of the colleges around. You've got, you know, good community colleges as well as universities, and ask them where they shop for things like that. And they can probably find you somebody. In fact, I'm going to make a note to ask Howard Garrett about that, if he knows anybody in the Mid-Cities area that might do that. But I'll tell you, at least make a call to Analytical Scientific here in San Antonio and see how they can help you, because they're really, really good people to deal with.
Okay, great. And what did you say was the step up, the stereoscope?
The stereoscope, you're basically putting a specimen in there and looking down on it at many diameters of magnification. A regular transmission scope is where you would take a, you know, a glass slide and put whatever on there. In many cases, then you put a little very thin glass, what's called a cover slip, on top of that. And that's going to give you, depending on the scope, you can only go so far without going to what we call an oil immersion lens and things like that. But there you're actually putting things on a microscope slide and, you know, and looking. And you can see a lot smaller things. Like I say, even a simple scope, you get up to maybe 150 diameters of magnification, and that lets you see a tremendous amount of things. But this is not something for somebody other than a, you know, teenager that's pretty good with things and has an interest in it. But Dad could always, you know, put some interesting things, you know, on the screen there, and then let the younger ones look through and see. But the simple stereoscope, anybody can use those, and it's all you need for looking at, at eggs, at minerals, or you'll find 1,000 different things, and you'll be amazed what it does for your kids. I think they'll be fascinated by it, and they're, you don't want to drop them, you don't want to abuse them, but you can get one that's going to be pretty kid-proof.
Got it. Okay. Thanks so much. Yeah, because we got a telescope, and boy, they love that.
instead of studying distant objects, you can study close-up objects. But keep listening if you're able this morning, and I'll try to, if I can remember to, I'll try to make that the first thing I ask Howard Garrett about when we talk at 8 o'clock, and see if he has a suggestion of somewhere in the Metroplex up there that you might be able to look for a good one.
Thanks so much, Bob. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, sir. Ah, okay, it looks like next in line is going to be Carol. Good morning, Carol. Hi, Carol.
Hi, how are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you this morning?
Good. I have a question that I need a definition on. What is the difference between top dressing and compost?
Top dressing typically has a sand added to it. Top dressing is traditionally compost plus, used to be Poteet red sand, but usually it's just a sand and compost mix, which makes it a little bit more suitable if you're trying to fill in, say you've put down grass squares and you've got those little valleys between them. Compost you would use for just like covering a yard. Top dressing you would use for leveling a yard, I guess, would be a good way to put it.
Well, with all the heat last year, I do have St. Augustine grass, and it gets a lot of sun. And some of it, if you dethatch it, you'll just see bare roots right now. It's just now coming out. I live in Fair Oaks. I'm wanting to put something on my grass, and I didn't know whether I should use top dressing or compost.
No, go with compost. Compost is going to be everything you need. It's going to be a little easier to spread, and your grass will love you for it. But don't mow it down too low. We never scalp St. Augustine like you can do Bermuda or Zoysia. Right. So don't cut it too close to the ground. But no, you just want good old compost. If you have small areas, you can buy it by the bag. If you have big areas, you can have somebody bring it out in a dump truck.
Okay, I thought I would get it at the old stone and soil and either have it delivered or have our lawn service do it.
I've been disappointed in them. I've had several people tell me the quality is not as good as it was when it was stone and soil. They're certainly, you know, the most convenient, and they are, you know, their products aren't bad. They have biosolids in most everything, which I don't like. There is one other place, and I think it might be called Blanco Materials or something like that. There's a material yard on Blanco Road just inside of Highway 46. If you're going down, I want to say it's probably within five miles down, be on the west side of the road. Someone that I trust very much who just moved to the area out there was in the nursery the other day and told me he had an extremely good experience there. So you might check them out before you decide exactly where to shop.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Carol. You have a wonderful Saturday out there and pray for rain. let's see here. Next in line is Tony. Good morning, Tony. Tony, are you with us? Okay. I tell you what, Don, I'm going to go ahead and get a break out of the way here and tell him to be listening to the telephone, not the radio, and we'll talk to him in just a minute. I get to talk about one of my favorite subjects and one of my favorite people, and that is Rhonda and all of her staff out at Rhonda's Nature's Way. You know, we're getting into hot weather now, and I've started drinking my favorite summertime solution when I'm out working and sweating a lot, and that is this wonderful material called Ultima. You need to have plenty of electrolytes in your system where you're losing a lot of sweat. And I tell you, one thing some people do is go and drink these sports drinks, and then they're wondered why they get fat because there's so much sugar in them. Well, Ultima has no carbohydrates to speak of and no sugars at all, and yet it gives you all the electrolytes, and it tastes pretty darn good. You've got your choice of about 6 or 8 different flavors. I happen to love raspberry, but I've tried all of them, and there's not a bad one out there, and Rhonda's is a great place to get it. Of course, I also see Rhonda for a couple of supplements I take. I take things to support my immune system, and Rhonda knows, and her staff, they know all of their products, and they can tell you what will work best. I had to visit with her one time about leg cramps when I was doing some really extreme work, and she had just the thing I needed. She also practices reflexology, does red light therapy and beamer therapy there at the store, and so much more. You just need to go see her. Today would be a great day. Just don't go on Sundays. She's closed Sundays and major holidays. But other days, open very reasonable daytime hours in the shopping center there at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, kind of directly across the parking lot from Sprouts, if that'll give you a good place to look. And if you're trying to lose weight, she's got lots of things that'll help you without giving up flavor and a little bit of good sweet taste. You just need to go see Rhonda and her staff at Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, back to the phone lines. It's going to be Tony and then James. Good morning, Tony.
Yeah, Bob. Can you hear me now?
I hear you loud and clear.
Okay. First thing is last week you talked to the dirt doctor, and he mentioned a book on propagation. Do you happen to remember what that was?
Let me flip over my little pad here. I tend to write things down, and it's called Plant Propagation by Alan Toogood, and I think that's spelled T-O-O-G-O-O-D. I won't swear to that, but it's simply called Plant Propagation by Alan Toogood.
Okay, thank you. And then the bald cypress, is that the one that puts out the little round seeds in the fall?
Well, it's actually a cone, believe it or not. Bald cypress and Montezuma cypress both put out that type of seed. They're actually a conifer. They're first cousin to pine trees, believe it or not. And that's actually its little modified cone. But the bald cypress, if it's in tight soil or in water, you'll distinguish it because it has these roots that sort of rise up, sometimes a foot or more off the ground. They call knees, whereas the Montezuma cypress rarely does that. Yes, sir.
Okay. And are those, is that where the seeds are, like a pine cone? They're in there?
Yes, sir. If you keep those little round balls, or if you let them mature until they're ready to fall off the tree, each one will break into about 10 or 15 pieces, each of which is the individual seed.
Okay, good deal. And then
they're fairly easy to germinate and grow out in nature. Apparently, little trees are pretty tasty, and deer, cattle, things like that will eat them, but you get them up to a good size, they're wonderfully easy to grow and a really good long life tree. In a real dry period, they may need a little supplemental water, but golly, they just don't. Once they get up and growing, they just don't have any problems.
And then I missed your conversation with the guy earlier on azomite. Does that need to be worked in or just put it on the surface?
It's one thing you can just put on the surface. Many people do work it in. Many people actually blend it into their soil mixes. But unlike the Aqualock, which is something I'm going to talk about in just a minute, the azomite can be put either blended in or on the surface. And it's one that I usually just put it on the surface for convenience sake.
Okay, well, my concern is my soil does not absorb water real good. It kind of beads up, and I was just concerned if I do get a little rain, it'll wash all to one side of the container.
Well, azomite is a rock product, so it would take a pretty good stream of water to really move it around a lot. But it will do all sorts of good things for your plants. It's not a real soil softener. It provides a lot of micronutrients. But if you're trying to soften that soil, things like Garrett juice or Medina Plus or, even just liquid molasses or molasses, actually dry molasses, those are all things that will soften your soil and help with the water absorbency. But the azomite just takes care of a lot of nutrient deficiencies, micronutrient deficiencies in your plants.
Okay, and that you mentioned Garrett juice. If I make my own Garrett juice off his recipe, is that the same, like 2 ounces to gallon?
Yeah.
Like the stuff you buy in the store?
Exactly. Yes, sir.
Okay. And just for your information, I got my buckets out here with a light on it, and it's just full of June bugs.
Reminded me of that, because that little June bug trap that Malcolm Beck's the one that first started me doing that, and I'm a little concerned about how many June bugs we're seeing this early, because one of my employees was he's saying, we don't have June bugs, we have March bugs, because they are usually, we don't see that many of them in March, but we're seeing, lots of people are telling me they're seeing lots of them. So I think we're probably going to be recommending getting some beneficial nematodes out a little early this year.
In this 5-gallon bucket here, there has to be hundreds of them just from overnight.
Wow.
I mean, it's the top of the water is just covered with them.
Yeah. Well, put a little bit of dish soap in there. They will sink, and it'll do them in more quickly, but you don't have to put much water in the bottom of the bucket, and you're going to be refilling it pretty often. So, you're getting ahead of it. And you're for every one of those June bugs you get rid of, you're potentially eliminating a few hundred grub worms. So you're doing the right thing, yes, sir.
Well, that the chickens prefer them without the soap. So
I'm hearing that rooster crowing in the background, and yeah, that's just such a happy country sound. So no, yeah, you just
ready to go.
Yeah. Well, you get out there and feed them and refill the bucket and take care of some more of them before they get a chance to lay eggs.
Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, brother. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Let's go ahead. I'm sorry, that was Tony, not Raul. But let's go ahead and talk to James. Good morning, James.
Morning, Bob. How you doing?
Well, I'm off to a good start. How about yourself?
I'm getting ready to get off to a good start.
Well, as several of my friends tell me, every morning you wake up, you're already off to a good start. So I'm not quite that pessimistic, but I guess there's a lot of truth in that statement.
Hey, Bob, I got these little green tomatoes on these celebrity plants in the hoop
very
house.
Very good. Yeah.
And I'm catching two corn earworm moths a night, just about.
Wow.
Or the tomato fruit worm.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that they don't lay their eggs on the small tomatoes. They wait till they get bigger. And
yeah,
where do they lay the egg on the tomato? Do you know?
They lay it on what they can find to lay it on. That little tomato actually has a much tougher skin than the bigger ones do. So yeah, it probably makes sense that they would not really be big, but they would be big enough, probably size of a grape or something like that, because that skin's just not as tough, and that little fruit worm won't have as much problem chewing a hole in your beautiful tomato. So I think it's going to be when they maybe get up to grape size is when you're really going to start having issues with them. But I tell you what, and I know you got your pheromone traps out and you catch a lot of the adult moths before they lay the eggs that way, but I'm still where you're fighting them. I like to spray a little BT and putting some molasses in it. That means that it will stay on the tomato and stay active for an extended period of time, because I don't want to give up. Even losing one tomato to the little fruit worms is too many. So I'd do two things. I keep your pheromone traps out, and hopefully you might even get some of the squash vine borer moths as well. But I'd put a little BT and molasses on the plants in addition.
Every time I spray them with compost tea, which has happened twice, I use the product called Dipel.
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's just a dry form of the Bacillus thuringiensis, and it's exactly the same thing. And that's the natural caterpillar killer.
Everybody sends me catalogs, Bob, and I've got a new catalog.
Okay.
From Young, J-U-N-G.
Uh-huh.
It's a seed catalog.
Okay.
I guess they've been around forever. They've been sending me catalogs for as long as I can remember. And you're always talking about carrot seed tapes.
Uh-huh.
And they've got them in that catalog, and they've all got all the good varieties.
Oh, that's good to know.
Seed tape.
Yeah. It's if anything's easier than the pelletized seed, I think the seed tapes are. Your pelletized seed is excellent for a serious gardener, but for somebody that's not real sure what they're doing, that seed tape works pretty well.
They've got all the yummy varieties. I was going through there and I go, oh man, these people really know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd mention that to you when I talked to you this morning.
Yeah, J-U-N-G, Young. I know that name well, but I did not realize they had the seed tapes, but I sure appreciate you telling us about it. So what else are you doing? What else is happening out there in the hoop house? And if you get tomatoes said, that ought to put a smile on your face.
Yeah, I always like to be the first one on the block, so Grandma comes back again, you know, when she gets some of my good celebrities. Everything's going pretty good. We're spraying compost tea like there's no tomorrow. We just built a 200-gallon batch of compost tea for the other farm. And that's a little bit more. We got corn planted and quite a big area over there. So it's compost tea, man, this time of the year.
I tell you what.
I had a question.
Yeah.
If I use the Thuricide, the liquid BT, I can't mix that with a compost tea for spraying the tomatoes. Right?
I don't know why not. I can't think of anything in compost tea that would be harmful, you know, to that little encysted bacteria. So, no, I would think you could put that in your compost tea without any problem.
Oh, that's great news. Okay, well, thanks for taking my call and answering all my questions, Bob.
It's always a pleasure talking with you, James. You get out and have a wonderful weekend and tell those hailstones to stay away from us.
Yes, sir, will do.
All right. Well, thanks again, and we'll talk again. Got a couple of open lines. Grab one of them if you like, 210-599-5555. While I pause for a minute here and talk about a great new company out there out of the Burney area called Aqualock, and veteran-owned. It's just it's a great company with a couple of interesting new products, and I think these things have a real place for most of us who garden. One of their products is called TerraLock, and it's what we would call a, it's like a colloidal material that helps hold moisture in the soil. It's a material made from natural things, including bananas of all things, but it's a dry product that you do want to blend into your soil, and it lasts for about a year and a half. It's gradually broken down, gradually just decomposes into carbon dioxide and oxygen, but it can really increase the amount of moisture in the soil without depleting the oxygen. Their other product that I like talking about is called Supercast, and it's a really, really good worm casting product to which they've added other biostimulants and just great things for your plants, and then adding a small amount of this same gel to help hold the moisture up around the plants and keep the nutrients there as well. Supercast and TerraLock, both great products. You're starting to find them at more nurseries. I know Rainbow was one of the original places to carry them and still carries them. We have them at Shades of Green now. You might ask your favorite nursery. Great products from the company called Aqualock. The products are called TerraLock and Supercast.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Looks like it's going to be Steve, Turkey Tom, and Jan. We start with Steve. Good morning. Morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Question on St. Augustine grass.
Okay.
I have a problem with just the seasonal weeds. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to control them, so I mowed them down.
Okay.
But I heard earlier that compost is what needs to be applied. I normally shop at Atkins, and they have a couple of varieties. I'm not sure which is best for the south of San Antonio. It's a dark soil. Mm-hmm. And they have one. Did you say stay away from the bio compost? Like
I think it's fine in a field, maybe in an orchard or something like that. But I don't like biosolids in the vegetable garden or on a, you know, grassy area where your pets are running around, your kids are running around barefoot. It's not that it's, you know, human waste that bothers me, but our waste stream today is so full of pharmaceuticals, so full of hormones, so full of residues of all sorts of nasty stuff that I just don't want biosolids in my compost.
So what's best for St. Augustine grass then?
Just, you know, any good either manure-based or plant-based compost will work just fine. It doesn't really make any difference. Just what you can find, and the compost, it's not going to do a whole lot for the weeds that are already there, but most of the weeds that you're fighting right now are things that are going to totally die when it gets hot. But they're going to be, you know, making plenty of seeds. And I think it's the humic acid, mainly, that's in the compost that just really works as a natural pre-emergent. And like I say, I've had better luck with compost as a pre-emergent herbicide than with any of the natural or chemical products.
So online, I see that they have something called manure compost, and it's a poultry and then / mushroom. I'm not sure what the poultry or the mushroom part is, but it looks what you described and be the closest.
Yeah, and that would be a very good blend. This is not something you're going to order online, and it is somebody that's talking about a product they have, because it's, you know, you're probably looking at buying, if you've got any area at all, buying it by the yard, whether you take your own truck or trailer to pick it up. But
Right.
Mushroom compost is basically made from the medium that they grow mushrooms on. We've got some big mushroom farms east of San Antonio. My only problem with mushroom compost is sometimes it's a little salty. The people who grow the mushrooms use salt as a way of sterilizing the bins where they grow it. Typically, that's not an issue, but I have seen a couple of them that are a little salty. Where you are, you know, something made from mushrooms plus poultry litter, that's going to be a great compost and actually be a pretty good fertilizer at the same time.
So do you still recommend Atkins soil, or do you recommend somebody else in the San Antonio area?
I'm having trouble finding a good company, actually. There's one over toward Castroville called Landscape Solutions and Nursery. This one out on Blanco Road is good. But if you've got one in the neighborhood offering you a good product that's based on mushroom and poultry manure, that's what I'm trying
poultry,
to say.
Yeah.
Get all you need before you tell anybody else. They'll get there and clean out the supplies. No, that sounds ideal to me.
All right. All right, sir. Well, thank you so much, and great job. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Steve. Appreciate the call this morning. Thank you, sir. Let's go ahead and talk to Turkey Tom next. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Bob. How are you this morning?
Oh, it's a beautiful morning out there, and the potential for good rainfall, it makes me smile. I'm always the eternal optimist and usually disappointed, but hopefully the weathermen will be right this time, because they're giving us like a 90% chance of good rain today. So let's hope it happens.
Well, I hope so. They missed it by a mile yesterday, but yeah, maybe we'll get it today.
I don't know. Wouldn't it be fun to have a job where you could be wrong 90% or 98% of the time and still get a paycheck? It just seems like the fancier the equipment they get, the worse their forecast becomes. So go figure.
Yeah, true. Well, I was calling, last time I talked to you, about male and female grapevines. And I heard you talking to Dirt Doctor later and a couple other callers. So I thought I'd explain it a little bit. Your wild grapevines, your Mustang grapes, your Muscadine grapes, they're called functionally dioecious. They have both male and female flowers, but the female vines, the stamen doesn't fully develop, and the male vines, the pistil doesn't fully develop.
Okay.
And so in the wild, they're functionally dioecious. They have both flowers, but only one sex of the flowers develops in the vine.
You have
so
just
that's
educated.
Why it was so easy with the improved varieties to make them self-fertile, because both flowers were already there on the vine.
That is a great explanation, and I sincerely appreciate you doing the research. You very much taught me something this morning, and Howard's probably listening and feels the same way.
Yeah, it's those little things like that. You know, we've had those vines here on the farm for, probably well over 100 years, and the same ones always produce, and the same ones never do. So
really interesting, and I presume you obviously know a great deal what the words monoecious and dioecious mean. It simply would translate to one house or two house, and I've always remembered that from my first biology 1 course, and that's an excellent way of explaining it. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Well, I had an observation for you too. So I put out compost over my yard, you know, about a month and a half ago or whatever it was in January.
Uh-huh.
And I've noticed where I put the compost, there's less weeds. Mm-hmm. And specifically less bull nettle, what we call puck shiva, but I think everyone else in the world calls bull nettle.
Yeah,
and I was wondering, does that control bull nettle, that compost, or is it just a coincidence?
No, I think it will control it as far as what comes back from seed. Now, the couple of places I've had bull nettle show up in my field, I'm not sure if it completely dies in the winter. And I don't think it would do a whole lot if it does come back from existing roots or underground stems. But it will have the same function as far as stopping new plants from coming up from seed, I'm quite sure.
Is there any way to control it? Because when I look outside, I see beautiful fields of big white flowers that are all that bull nettle. That's the only wildflowers we seem to get on the back half of the property. And, of course, they're not the ones I want to touch.
Yeah, and you're not confusing it with what we call prickly poppy, which has a white flower with a yellow center. The true bull nettle has a much smaller white flower. But
that's what I'm confusing it with.
Yeah, it's prickly poppy is it's not pleasant, but bull nettle, I mean, it'll make you swell up, and it really, really causes the prickly poppy is an irritant. The bull nettle is a real threat. But the prickly poppy, that is very much from seed, and I think you'll find the compost will control that, limit it very well.
Okay, that's.
But
yeah,
are the flowers? The flowers are 2-3 inches in diameter.
Yes, sir, and they get about knee high.
Yeah, that's a prickly poppy. The bull nettle's much lower, and if you walk through that stuff, you'll be hurting for a couple hours.
Okay. And one other question, I heard you talk to a caller about a June bug trap, and is that just a bucket of water under a light? What's the difference there?
Again, it's so funny talking to him and hearing the rooster crowing in the background, and he obviously just catches them and then feeds them to his chickens, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
But if you want to, if you don't have chickens, put a little bit of soap in it. The June bugs will sink and drown much more quickly that way. But yeah, it's just I have used one of those little clip-on lights and just put it on the edge of a 5-gallon bucket. The June bugs fly down, bang into the light, drop in the water, and that's the end of them.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. It's kind of like fishing, but I'm guaranteed to catch something on those.
Yep. It's the only thing that is more fun. I stood out on my patio one time and watched a big old toad sitting on the ground underneath the light, and that June bug would, you know, hit the light, hit the ground, and that toad's tongue was so fast, it's like, now you see it, now you don't. That June bug would hit the pavement and bam, it just all of a sudden just instantly disappeared. And that's the only thing I can think of with June bugs much more fun than that June bug trap. Yes, sir.
Well, I've gotten to the point I'm not even turning our porch lights on this year because we have just a infestation of biblical proportions out here. I turn those porch lights on within 5 minutes. I've got probably 200 or 300 June bugs on the porch.
Oh, man.
And I just got to the point, the porch light's off, and if I need to go outside, I use the flashlight, and I run quickly so they can't get me.
Well, and if you get out like I do sometimes to open a gate or something like that, be certain you close that door, because if you leave it standing open, like the tendency is to do, then the rest of your trip you'll have a buzzing around inside the car or truck, which isn't much fun. So, listen, thanks so much for sharing. Great information, and I do sincerely appreciate it.
Have a good morning, Bob. Thank you.
You do the same, sir. Thank you. All right, let me get my last break of the hour in, and we will keep going. It looks like I get to talk to you about, the good folks that make the Nature's Creation products. And there's just so many good products that they make, and including a great fungicidal cornmeal. They make a good, what we call spreadable corn gluten meal, which is the natural pre-emergent. And then, of course, what they want me to especially focus on today is one of their fertilizers, which is high in mycorrhizal fungi. They inoculate it with so many different ones. They call it their turf food, 4-3-2 formulation, I believe it is. And once again, just a top-quality product. I also love their premium lawn and garden food, which is a cornmeal, I'm sorry, a an alfalfa-based product as well. I just pretty much like all the different products from Nature's Creation. Lots of soils, mulches, garden soil mixes. Like I said, they package the fungicidal cornmeal. They package a lot of different quality products. Most all of them are organic. Some of them are certified organic. You're going to find them at fine nurseries throughout the area, specifically the ones they wanted me to talk about, or Earthworks over in Victoria, Friendly Natives up in Fredericksburg, Naylor's down in Corpus, Fanix here in San Antonio. Most every good nursery out there is going to carry quality products from our friends at Nature's Creation.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. Don tells me that looks like Jan dropped off, probably headed out to do a couple of other things. So let me just take a couple of minutes and talk a little bit about weather and things coming up. Do have the potential for some rough weather from what we hear this evening. And for those of y'all who have put out tomato plants and things, it'd be a good time if you, at least what I would suggest, if they're not too big, to just take an empty, say, 5-gallon nursery bucket or utility bucket or something like that. Just turn them upside down, put a rock or something on top to hold them in place in case we do get some substantial wind and hailstones along with it. Hopefully we will not have hail, but, you know, you just prepare for the worst, and it generally doesn't happen. And the Weather Service is saying that we do have the potential for at least small hail this evening, and, boy, that's hard on tender young tomato plants and things like that. If you already have your cages over them, you can use, and I've in the past have just used pieces of insulate and things like that, that I'll put partway up across the top and just hold them in place with clothespins, and that will certainly stop, you know, small hail. But remember, it may be coming at an angle, so kind of across the top and down the sides as well. Boy, a good rain would certainly be welcome, but just we worry a little bit about hail. And things coming up, you know, in rows, once again, if you can turn something upside down over them. Years ago, I made some little, they look kind of like a goalpost without the top pieces, just three pieces of pipe, one of them about 8 feet long, and then two of them about 2 feet long, one on either end, that I could just push down into the ground. And then I just put a piece of insulate cloth over the top of that, anchor the edges of it. That's what I've used for frost protection for a long time, but it will also give you a fair amount of hail protection as well. So hopefully that's not going to be an issue, but just be sure whatever you do, anchor it in place, because with a thunderstorm you can, of course, get some gusty winds. It is a great time to plant tomatoes, plant peppers, plant eggplant, squash, cucumbers, bush beans. I think you're pretty much okay to plant all these things now. Would hold off on really hot weather things like okra. Okra, wait till after Easter, or maybe even the 1st of May, to set your okra out, because it wants hot soil. It doesn't want warm soil. It wants hot soil to germinate and grow well. But, I think you're fine on tomatoes and peppers now. And squash, keep in mind with squash that there are vining forms, and they're the so-called bush forms, which don't spread out nearly as much. If you're growing in containers, you probably want the bush form. If you have a small garden, I think you'll find the bush form gives you more fruit per square foot of garden. And if you're growing cucumbers and things, if you don't have a trellis, just use an extra tomato cage or something like that. I've grown cucumbers for years on extra tomato cages, and works very well. Beans, I highly recommend bush beans as opposed to pole beans. Pole beans produce over a longer period of time, but really hot summer, I've had very disappointing production from pole beans. But my favorite bush bean early in the season is one called Tavera, T-A-V-E-R-A, very heavy producer. When we really get into the hot weather, your next crop, you probably want to plant Contender or Top Crop or one of those varieties that seems to take the heat a little bit better. So many things to talk about, and we'll be talking about with the Dirt Doctor right after news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening, but don't dial right this minute. We'll save the last 30 minutes or so of the show for more questions. But right now is that special time on Saturday mornings when we get to visit with a very special gardener, that being Mr. Howard Garrett, the Dirt Doctor. Good morning, Howard.
Well, how's everybody down that way?
Anticipating potentially good rains, worried about getting a little severe stuff going, but had a Dallas caller earlier this morning, said y'all have gotten some pretty good rains up in your part of the world.
Yeah, I parred the first hole, made a really nice up and down, was walking to the second tee, and we got rained out and canceled for the day. We had a nice big sale that came on top. The weather guessers said it was going to move on out real quickly, but it just sat there, and we got real nice rain.
I tell you, we're sure ready for that down in our part of Texas, but it'll come. It's just been y'all have been blessed with good rains. It seems like for the past several months, that just as soon as you start to get a little on the dry side, you got some good moisture came in, and hopefully we'll get up to that. But I really appreciated the picture, and I want to talk about that in just a second. But you may have heard earlier a caller from the Dallas area was asking, he wants to get a microscope for his relatively young kids. I was suggesting the binocular stereoscope or dissecting scope, whatever you want to call it. And I was wondering if you had a suggestion of where somebody would go looking for that kind of thing up in the Metroplex area.
Well, I heard that, and I had a name of a place in the back of my feeble brain, so I was doing some little quick research on it, and I ran into a couple of interesting things. This company I was trying to think of is Pike Agro Labs Supplies, and I thought about it because it's the place that in the past had the Phil Callahan paramagnetism meter.
Oh, really? Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so I did Callahan paramagnetism meter, Pike Labs, and sure enough, it comes up Phil Callahan meter on the page of Pike Agro Labs, and then there's a note there that says there's no items in this category. So apparently they have quit handling it, which is kind of disturbing. On the other hand, it may be partially my fault that I hadn't promoted it more. You know, what it means is that nobody else other than, you know, Malcolm and you and me and other people that are heavily into organics talk about it at all. And I guess we should have pushed it and made a bigger deal out of it. Maybe it would still be around. I'm going to give them a call Monday and see what the deal is and see if maybe we can get the thing back on the market. But anyway, they sell other testing equipment and all. And I didn't see specifically the kind of thing that you were looking for, but I think if they don't handle it, they could probably give somebody advice on who to go to in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. It's Pike, P-I-K-E, Pike Agro Lab Supply.
Very good. Well, I imagine he's still listening. If not, he'll call me back, and I will pass it along to him, and appreciate it very much. Yeah, I may have to ask Analytical Scientific down here if they are familiar with something we can use to test. The good thing about, you know, the paramagnetism was being able to just tell what the level was, how strongly paramagnetic something was. And, gosh, I'm sorry if that's not out there anymore. Hopefully somebody is still making something like that, because it's a great way to judge, you know, certainly the quality of lava sand, or you were mentioning some of the other basaltic sands and things like that. And it'd be fun just to be able to see what the level of paramagnetism was in some of those things.
Owners have or not, the azomite, you would think it has a fairly good level because it's, you know, volcanic ash is the basis of that product. But anyway, I'll talk to them, and they sell things like refractometers and things like that. So that's probably a pretty good thing for people to know about anyway.
Oh, absolutely. And absolutely.
Maybe we can find out what happened to the Callahan meter and help to get it back on the market and then talk about it more often. It wasn't even a very expensive meter. It was so simple the way it worked and everything. And the other interesting thing that I ran into, I did just a Google search for on paramagnetism. The first thing that comes up is some website that recommends 50 books that are the best books on organics and paramagnetism and related things. And, of course, none of our books are mentioned in any of it, so I was very impressed with that website. But then the next two entries on the Google search were paramagnetism as explained on DirtDoctor.com, and then the next one was paramagnetism explained in the Texas Organic Research Center website. So,
well, two out of three is not bad.
So I'm going to pull out. In fact, I sent a copy of it to myself. I'm going to update it and get some photographs in there of the paramagnetism meter and stuff like that and talk to Pike Lab this week and see what's up with all that. As we get more and more of these vegetable gardens in, you know, more and more people are going to need to have refractometers and paramagnetism meters and things like that, or be able to buy products from people who have those meters and can tell folks, you know, what's the level of paramagnetism in the lava sand and the basalt and the azomite and soils and composts that they're buying and using, because it absolutely makes a difference. There's no question about it.
Oh, yeah, and that refractometer, which, you know, used to measure the level of sugar or bricks in different vegetables and things, that's really interesting, and for somebody that's in the business professionally, it's almost critical to know how good a job you're doing of getting the bricks level up on things, not just from a flavor standpoint, but from the all the research that shows as the bricks level gets higher, the insects stay away from things a whole lot more. So, yeah, I actually have two refractometers. I like those things so much.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, and they're not very expensive. They're very simple to use as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thanks for sending the picture of the round garden. Looks like it's looks like you're coming along well and getting ready to pour concrete at this point.
Well, it's been slowed down a little bit because of the rain, and it's probably not going to be poured till next week, but I'll continue to send you shots of it. It's going to be fun to get it all in. We've got the arborists on site, too, doing work. We had some big live oaks that are a little bit too close to the garden. We're having to do some weight reduction and some root pruning on one side, and, of course, the leafy vegetables and things that can take some shade will go in on that side, but the employees there are excited about it, and it's going to be in business within a couple of weeks, and we'll see if it's as fun as I think it's going to be.
What have you decided on a watering system? I see that piece of pipe lying across it. I presume you're going to put some pipes underneath the sidewalks that you can feed electrical or water lines through. How have you addressed future watering needs in there?
Well, we're going to kind of retrofit the irrigation system that's there first, and then we may add a few more heads, and we may add some drip. We're going to just kind of play it by ear as we go. I'm kind of like, you know, Malcolm Beck and I were kind of on the same page years ago about not being that thrilled about drip irrigation in certain situations and wanting to water from above. So I'm going to have at least a way to water the whole garden with above-ground sprinklers so we can wet the foliage and everything. But we'll probably have some drip as part of the system as well.
And potential to do just some watering with a hose, just follow-up hand watering, or are you going to rely on handheld?
Yeah, one of the things we're going to do, the owner bought some vans from some source at some point a year ago or so, and I was talking to him about where we were going to store equipment and do all that kind of thing, and he told me about these vans, so we're going to keep a lot of the equipment in these vans, and they'll be mobile, obviously, so we can move them around and use them where we need to. But I'm going to get all of the tools that I recommend so highly on site so they can experience those and show other people about them. The hose that I recommend that the owner's been too hard-headed about, you know, working together to get it marketed. It's by far the best hose out there, but nobody knows about it. It's a real super lightweight, non-toxic hose that literally won't kink. And we'll have it on site to do hand watering. We'll have the Hori knives, probably two or three different kinds, so people can see the different ways you can go there. And then the push-pull hose, I'm going to have the stirrup hoe and the Rogue makes one. Y'all probably sell it. They're shades of green. It's real high-quality steel, and it's triangular in shape, and it's sharp on all three sides. Y'all have that one? Have you tried that one?
I don't know if we have it in there. That's another one. It's gotten harder to find, even the good stirrup hose. And, of course, you get good quality steel. They get a little pricey. But, boy, anybody that has one absolutely loves them. I certainly know the one you're talking about, but I'm going to have to go look and see if that's one we've been able to find, because quality garden tools are not easy to find.
Well, the Rogue tools across the board are really good. I think they're one of the companies. There's another one that does this as well. It uses Rogue uses wooden handles, and there's another company out there that uses yellow fiberglass. And I think both of them use old plowshares as discs as their source of steel. And apparently that's a real high-quality steel.
Interesting.
And, it's there's a couple of companies. I think I'm almost sure Rogue does it. Maybe the other company. One company came to us. It was a startup. They were going to do a whole new line, I think, and they were doing it for sure. And we got some samples of their stuff. And I still use theirs, but I don't know if they actually put it on the market or not. I didn't know if y'all had run into them.
I have not, but I've made notes here, and I'm very definitely going to look for them.
You know, some of the big brand names, they're okay, but one, they're not as good as some of these other things, and they tend to be in the big box stores where you don't have some of the tools that we really do recommend so highly, like the quality Hori knives and the push-pull stuff, and real quality short-handle Bill Dookies or sharpshooters, I think, is very important gardening tool. It's one of the tools I use probably more than any other tool in my tool chest back there.
That's other than a digging bar, which you have to have down here, but that sharpshooter is
the rock. Yeah,
yeah. The broader shovels are just to take dirt out of the hole, in my opinion. But it's finding good tools can be quite a challenge. We were very disappointed. We love a line of pruning shears called ARS, and one of the suppliers we get it from is not going to have them in the future, and so we're looking around for others as well, because I hate to say it, but just steel is, there's just a lot of not-so-good stuff out there, and the Swiss and, I think Norway is where we've gotten some of the stirrup hose that we still sell, but it's an ongoing effort to try to find good quality out there, that's for sure.
Well, the pruning shears that I use, and I think are three times better than anything on the market, are the steel.
Yeah.
Pruning shears. They're real high quality stainless steel and black handles, real simple looking, and they're scissor type. And I was talking to the arborist on the site, and they were uncovering a bunch of spaghetti roots when they were doing the root flare exposure. And it's really interesting to look at that. Now I've got pretty good experience, you know, on a lot of trees, and it seems that live oaks do that worse than any other tree. And some of them do it a lot worse than others, and some of it do it with spaghetti roots that are as literally as thin as pasta spaghetti, you know, really thin and just a mass. And then others, the spaghetti roots will be up the size of a good sized cigar or something
yeah.
like that.
Oh, yeah.
So it really varies, and it appears to depend on how deep the flare is buried. And the other thing that I'm really keeping an eye on, and I've got the best example of it a block from my house here. If you don't fix the spaghetti roots that are on your live oak tree and you just leave them there, mm-hmm. they will fuse together into a solid mat. And it looks like a gigantic flare, but it's really not. And once
yep.
you allow that to happen, the tree will survive, but it's never going to reach its potential. It's never going to be as good as it can be. There's a house near me, like I was saying, where that mass like that covers the entire half of their front yard. It is
wow.
the most dramatic thing you've ever seen. You can walk up on it and put the lawn chairs on it. It's so big.
Wow. Well, I think you saw last time you were down here the tree that we discovered was such a problem here in the nursery. Then we got Edder out with the air spade, and it was really a mess, like you say. The air spade did a good job of exposing the problem, but then it was quite an ordeal to get in there. And the tree is looking better, and I think that tree would have died pretty shortly if we hadn't done something. So
it would have continued to go downhill for sure.
Yeah. And it looks like at this point, even what's it been probably 6 months since we did that, it looks like it's going to come out much better. So I'm 100% with you there. It's a problem you have to take care of if you're going to protect the trees. And I think crepe myrtles are probably second in line, but the live oaks do seem to be the absolute worst about doing that.
Yeah, crepe myrtles are up there. I'll tell you another tree, and it would surprise most people, that's real high on that making spaghetti roots is ball cypress.
Really?
It's interesting, you know, the ball cypress will grow under water, but it
uh-huh.
doesn't like to be too deep in the soil. It's kind of a curious head scratching thing, but yeah, I've uncovered some ball cypress that had a sizable amount of spaghetti roots. And by the way, when anybody uncovers that kind of situation, don't worry about cutting all that stuff off. A lot of people think, oh, I'm going to do some damage to the tree.
Right.
Not at all. You won't do any damage. As a matter of fact, the tree will sigh of relief and start growing better and getting out of stress immediately.
Oh, yeah.
This same project, the owner called me, and he said, Howard, some of the trees on the property have mistletoe in them. Can you have the guys take care of the mistletoe while they're there? And I said, yeah, I'll remind them, George, but you need to remember that the sick tree treatment will completely eliminate it all, and that's really all you have to do. He said, fine. He's a Marine as well. He says, advice accepted. Tell them to step down.
Yep, all you need is sick tree treatment and a little bit of patience, and it just goes away. It's interesting because I was looking at it on a couple of trees recently, and it literally shrivels and dies. And you could the tree I was looking at still had a few green clumps here and there, but and it seemed I don't know exactly what the mode of action is, but the lower limbs where they had some mistletoe started, it just literally was shriveled up and brown and dead. So that'd be another thing that'd be fun to take some pictures of and study it over a little bit of time and watch how it happens.
Well, speaking of that, I got a call on my show last week from somebody. I think they were in East Texas in sandy soil. They were in Nacogdoches or someplace over there. And they had a great big red oak tree, and they said it was full of mistletoe and obviously in stress. And so I started to go into sick tree treatment stuff, and she said, well, I've been listening for a while, and the flare's exposed beautifully, and we've been totally organic. And I said, now, this is an interesting little poser.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, send me some photographs. I said,
You cut out there for a second, Howard. You said send some photographs and what now?
of the tree so we figure out what else is going on with this tree. You know, too deep, it's not too deep in the soil. She said the flower was exposed beautifully. But there's got to be something else. If the tree still has mistletoe, I said, we got to figure out what it is. Contaminated soil, a perched water table, not draining properly, something. And they haven't sent me pictures yet, so I haven't taken it to the next step. But
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say one thing that I've discovered is the root flare can be exposed and you can still have girdling roots. Just because you've exposed the root flare doesn't mean you've identified the entire problem, because sometimes if that root flare includes a couple of girdling roots, and the other thing is, as you've emphasized before, a root doesn't have to go all the way around the tree to girdle it if it's just pressing hard against one side. And I've come across that a time or two where somebody said, oh, no, the root flare is exposed. But then when they send you a picture of it, you see that big old root pressed up against. And it's real interesting how that side of the tree where that girdling root is pressuring it, that's the side of the tree that will start looking bad first.
Yeah, if that part of the trunk's going straight in the ground or even tilted back toward the tree, you still need to go down at that point. But the flares that are exposing up above the ground, you know, if they don't have anything girdling across them at that point, they're not going to be a problem.
Oh, no.
So anyway, we're still trying to figure that one out. Now, if I ever get any photographs, we'll see if we have some additional recommendations for her and pass it on to everybody, because it's a very interesting situation.
Well, one other thing that I wanted to mention that we're seeing down here is huge numbers of June bugs. Just all of a sudden, within the past week or so, you probably heard the caller earlier talking about getting out his bucket with a light on it. But boy, we're getting June bugs, getting lots and lots of them early. So sure, looking like we're going to have to warn people about grubs and getting the beneficial nematodes out probably earlier than we've ever recommended before.
Well, I got mine out a week ago, and I've been recommending that this year. I normally recommend putting out the nematodes and the trichogramma wasp as plants emerge. And of course, you know, we've been in that window. So people need to get them out, take care of fleas at the same time, and a lot of other insect pests as well.
Fleas and fire ants, and yeah, the trichogramma is another really important thing. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's certainly the best way to take care of all those little caterpillars that want to feed on that new foliage. And it has been a most interesting spring, because the live oaks especially, it seems, I would say on a typical year, they probably drop 80% of their leaves, but this year they're pretty much dropping 100% of their leaves, and it's going to be beautiful if we can get the trichogram out and keep the little gallworms and things from coming out, because the trees are going to have just almost 100% fresh new foliage on them, and should continue to be just a real beautiful spring.
Well, even my big loquat leaf oak is defoliating almost everything this year. It normally keeps green leaves on it. I've been bragging about it for several years that it's one of the few trees that just is always green, but this year, like you're saying, it's kicking everything off. Now the new stuff is already popping out. It's going to be a very short period of time and it's mainly on the top third of the tree too. But you're right, it is a little different this year.
Just makes it fun. Just when you think you've got it figured out, Mother Nature will throw something different at you. But had a customer the other day that has was talking about they got a loquat leaf oak from somewhere on your recommendation. We're so pleased at how well it was doing, but it was some obscure source that they hadn't been able to get anymore. So if yours starts making acorns, I know a lot of people would sure like to plant a few acorns and see if we can't get some more of them growing.
Well, it may be old enough to do it this year. We'll see. On the other hand, if it has genetics that doesn't allow it to produce acorns very much at all, long term for most people, that would be a beneficial thing, you know.
So, yeah.
we'll just keep an eye on it.
Absolutely. Well, I hope you get your a complete round of golf in sometime this week. Hope you get your good rain, because still just I haven't played since my college days, or not much since then. But sure is a great form of exercise out there, and it certainly teaches you concentration, because I can tell you from experience, if you're thinking about anything except that little white ball, you're not going to play very well.
Well, there's a guy that's playing at the Players right now, Wyndham Clark. He's probably the most famous golfer in the world that people don't know the name, but he's won the U.S. Open last year, and he's like five or six shots ahead in the tournament this week. He knows how to think about it properly, apparently. He can really play.
Well, I think
we're going to get rained out today, so it's going to be – I'm already canceling my gardening activities. My help are coming over. I think we're going to be washed out again today. So, and then Sunday and early next week, hopefully it'll be clear enough for us to get the concrete poured and all that stuff on the community garden we've got going over in Grand Prairie.
Well, and get that soil good and, you know, well settled so that the concrete stays in place. Are you putting a broom finish or a pebble finish? Or are you putting some kind of finish on the concrete so it'll be a little rougher surface and not slippery?
Well, we looked at doing exposed aggregate. I really wanted to do a basalt gravel exposed aggregate, but it was just so much more money that I really couldn't justify talking the owner into doing it. So it's just going to be a brush concrete finish with plenty of expansion joints so we can try to control where the cracks are. I had a friend, a contractor years ago, he was a crusty old guy, and he said he was a concrete expert. He said, I know everything there is to know about concrete. And, oh, yeah, really? Conway, what is all you know? He said, concrete is gray, it gets hard, and it cracks. That's all you need to know.
Well, fortunately, that's not the entire story, but it's an interesting take on it, I'll put it that way. And that certainly is a true statement of what concrete, at least a lot of concrete, is and does, but there are a few things you can do to minimize the problems and maximize the benefits of it. But sure. The one thing that, you know, so many people just want to make that pretty smooth surface. And why, I tell everybody that gardens, you do not want to do that, because you get it a little bit moist. And I think every greenhouse owner I've known that poured slick concrete walkways in there has ended up either with a broken wrist or, you know, a broken elbow or something like that from sliding down on it. Because anywhere you're doing lots of watering like the garden, you're going to get some algae and it's going to get slick.
Yeah, you got to be careful with that. You can knock it out with hydrogen peroxide and some other things, but can become a problem. I was telling Judy yesterday, our little koi pond, it's the water is so beautifully crystal clear, it's unreal. And as I told you, I use the hydrogen peroxide from time to time, every time the string algae gets going. But right now, which I've done once this year already, but it's beautiful. And the moss on the rocks on the side are growing and growing and growing and just looking beautiful. Whenever you use the hydrogen peroxide, be real careful not to be splashing it around too much. Pour it gently into the water so you don't hurt some of that real pretty fragile growth like moss that might be growing on the rocks on the side of the water feature.
Sounds like a wonderful additional article somebody I know needs to do and put up there on dirtdoctor.com, because water features are just getting more and more popular, but there sure is a lot to know about them. And I'll have to send you a picture of a box of something we found on a couple of older concrete structures that had a little crack in it. It's kind of an epoxy material called Pond Shield that really does a great job of sealing a crack where you've got a concrete feature leaking water. But I'll try to get that to you sometime soon as well.
Okie dokie. Sounds good. I think I've heard you mention that before, and I haven't tried it, so I'd like to give it a try. In fact, I've got a little stone feature, water feature holds about 2 quarts of water, and it's got a crack in it bad enough to leak out within about 5 or 6 hours. So I'll try it on that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if I get out, I'll pick up a box of it for you and get it off to you. But anyway, as always, have really enjoyed our visit, and I'm about halfway through my list of potential things to talk about, so I think we better just schedule this again for next Saturday morning.
It's always fun. Enjoyed it.
Howard, thank you as always. Hope tomorrow you get your round in, and keep the pictures coming. I've got a lot of people down here asking me and talking about your project up there, and so it's always fun to share, and you know, give the dogs a pet and the ladies a hug, and I'll look forward to our next visit.
Thanks, Bob. See you guys later.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Howard Garrett is the Dirt Doctor, dirtdoctor.com, best website on the internet. Golly, we ran on with that a little bit, but just interesting things to talk about. Let me get my last break of the show in, and then I think we'll probably have time for at least a few phone calls. I get to talk to you about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, and I'm sure that those of you all that are looking at that weather forecast and seeing hail, if you've got an old shingle roof, you probably get nervous, because hailstones just tear those roofs up. You know, we don't worry, though, because we have Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roofs on our home and our nursery here, and our roof on Shades of Green has stood up to baseball-size hail with nothing more than, you really have to search to find even a cosmetic dent in it. If you want a roof that you just simply don't have to worry about, you want a roof from Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. They stand up to the heat, to the cold, to the hail, to the wind. It's just the best metal out there, installed by the best installers in the world. Love our Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roofs. And so many choices. You can have different colors. You can actually have a different look to the material. Doesn't have to look like standing seam. Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roofs save you money on your energy bill every month because they are so energy efficient. In fact, many insurance companies will give you a discount on your homeowner's insurance because they know they're not going to be paying for hail damage. How many reasons do you need? Southwest Metal Roofing Systems does new construction as well as roof replacement. Give them a try, and I think you'll like them as well as we all do. Phone number 822-6868. That's 210-822-6868. For Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It looks like we've got Cindy and Elizabeth waiting to talk. Cindy is first in line. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have some conversations I'd like to know about of shrubs.
Okay.
We lost quite a few shrubs and trees, and with our freezes that we've had. So,
right.
Looking into replacing, and it's all full sun. And I know you've talked before about xylosma, but I can't remember, is that a good one or a bad one?
Well, it's one that certainly suffered some freeze damage. So, it's not quite as high on our list where, you know, where that's a concern. How tall do these things need to get to do the job you need?
I need a privacy to go a little bit over our privacy fence.
Okay. Some of the hollies seem to be among the most freeze resistant. Unfortunately, they're a little slower growing, but Nellie Stevens is a very good one. Actually, you know, these are the bigger hollies, but there's Foster's holly, there's Nellie Stevens, there's standard Burford holly, and these are large-leaved, fairly dense shrubs. Now, there's also the small-leaved holly that we call yopon, and it will certainly get up to 12 to 15 feet, and they have proven quite cold-hardy. The other one that's probably going to be a pretty good screening shrub is going to be Japanese yew, Podocarpus. It has turned out to be, you know, I've not seen it where it suffered much from the, three cold winters that we've had now.
We lost four of them.
Oh, really? Well, you've gotten a little colder. I don't think you'll have any problem with the hollies. Another plant that has done well in my yard, and of course I get a lot colder in Bernie than we do here in San Antonio, But the Lady Banks Rose, the Rosa Banksia, there are two forms, one with white flowers, one with yellow. They don't have thorns, which is wonderful. The deer don't seem to like them. And that one has, you know, mine, I didn't see any freeze damage whatsoever on it. And it takes up a little room because it does spread out, but it would get big enough to, you know, make a nice screen. There are some of the, I don't like running bamboos at all, but some of the clumping bamboos, Alphonse Carr, Golden Goddess, some of those, some of them got a little cosmetic damage, but they also came right back. And if you're just looking for a 6 to 8 foot screen, I think they're very much worth considering.
Okay. Now, I mean, I really loved my Japanese yews, but do they do well in full sun?
Oh, yeah.
We were thinking that maybe they shouldn't have been in the full sun.
No, they tolerate the full sun really well. And just my observation, anybody that had any problem with them, they were not watering them thoroughly and deeply. And I think that there are a number of things that suffered more than they needed to because the cold came after a period of being so dry. And all these things, golly, they need a thorough, deep, deep soaking before it gets cold.
Okay. And I saw a variegated privet, which would add some different colors, but I don't know. What do you think about it?
It's not an especially long-lived plant, but all the privets are moderately hardy. The variegated one, I can't say that I remember where anyone has a big one in a landscape, but generally speaking, they're pretty hardy. Now, some of the waxleaf ligustrums, they got a little bit, which are an effect of privet as well, but they got a little bit of cold damage, but the smaller leaf privets seem to have come through very well, so that would also be a possibility.
Okay, and then what about a cypress?
Cypress not evergreen, so they certainly are very cold hardy. Now, I'm not fond of the Arizona cypress and some of those. They have suffered some cold damage, but if you're talking about the tree form, the Taxodium, they certainly, you know, take everything Mother Nature throws at them. So, anyway, I hope that gives you some help there. And, Don, let's go ahead and get our last break of the show out of the way, and then we will be back and finish up with Elizabeth.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
It is good day to do all sorts of things. If you're planting outside, you might want to hold off till tomorrow because they are giving us this chance of some hail and maybe potentially severe weather this evening. But lots of good rain, and we can certainly use that. But this is one of the few times that I'll say keep those tomato plants in the garage or, you know, some bright place for just another maybe 36 hours before you put them out, just in the event that we do get some hail this evening or overnight, because they're giving us a better chance than usual that we could get some severe weather. Any luck on the phone lines, Don? Okay, well, we apparently have an issue there, so I'll just fill you in on a couple of other things. And do prepare, if you've got tomato plants and things out again, I just empty nursery containers or buckets, turn them upside down, weight them down with a big rock or something like that so they don't blow around. But just in case we do get a little bit of severe weather this afternoon. If you've got pruning work to do, boy, this is a time to get it done. You don't want to prune spring flowering things until they're finished flowering. Right now, spireas in full bloom, Indian hawthorns are starting to bloom. So let them finish their blooming. Your mountain laurels, lots of them are finishing up, but just as soon as the blooms start to fade, this will be the time to prune those things. Now, summer flowering plants like crepe myrtles, you got to get them pruned right away. They're starting to come out, and you really don't want them to put on a lot of growth and then have to cut that off. So if they need pruning, do so. Your climbing roses, let them bloom first and then prune them. I'm going to tell you, unless you've got just really spindly growth on them, don't do any more pruning on your bush roses. It was good to get them in February, but so many of them are coming out with such beautiful new foliage, lots and lots and lots of buds. Put away your pruning shears when it comes to the things. Let's try what now, Don? Let's try Elizabeth one more time and see if the phones work. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Glad we got you.
Earlier in the show, there was a man up in the panhandle having trouble finding Medina products.
Right.
And I'm in the same boat. I'm in an organic gardening resource desert. HEB carries Texas Organics 40-pound 323 all-purpose fertilizer, and the bag says developed by Medina Growing Greens.
Very
so
good.
HEB picks up the slack, and they usually, if it's a big HEB plus, they've usually got Medina has to grow in two different forms. So that helps, but there isn't one north of Lubbock. I looked.
I'm sure there'll be one of these days. They've moved, they're down into Mexico as far as where my little sister lives in Saltillo. But, and they're, I find that they're very responsive, and to their credit, just tell your organic gardening friends to ask for it, because I was complimenting the manager of our HEB up in Bernie on how much organic material and produce and everything they carried. And he said, the chain will let me carry anything that sells. So on those Medina products, on anything else organic, if people are asking for them, if people are buying, then they're happy to put them on the shelf. So I'm glad to know that at least they're taking an interest in doing that. But just remember, if you want to keep seeing them, keep buying them, because they are very definitely focused on sales. But to their credit, they're doing a lot of things right.
Yeah, that's real true. Well, thank you for your show, and good luck with your phones.
Well, that's above and beyond me. I've got great engineers to work with back at the station, and I'm sure they'll have it all worked out by tomorrow when we'll be doing this again. You get out and keep all the severe weather way up there in the panhandle, but send us some good rains. I know you need it like we do, but golly, you've had some rough things happening up in that part of the world. It's about time for Martin Bomba here, and all about your home improvement questions. So he'll be up right after 9 o'clock. I hope you join me again tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock for more gardening here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.